me back. I've tried everything. I've pretended to be all sorts of people. I've said it's urgent.
What's funny?
I was just wondering why none of these people who keep interviewing you have offered you a job, said Strike.
Oh, said Robin, blushing faintly. They have, all of them. I've accepted the human resources one.
Oh, right, said Strike. You didn't say. Congratulations.
Sorry, I thought I told you,
lied Robin. So you'll be leaving when?
2 weeks.
Ah. I expect Matthew's pleased, is he?
Yes, she said, slightly taken aback. He is.
It was almost as if Strike knew how little Matthew liked her working for him. But that was impossible. She had been careful not to give the slightest hint of the tensions at home. The telephone rang, and Robin answered it.
Cormoran Strike's office.
Yes, who's speaking, please?
It's Derek Wilson, she told him, passing over the receiver.
Derek, hi. Mr. Bastigui's gone away for a couple of days, said Wilson's voice. If you want to come and look at the building. I'll be there in half an hour, said Strike.
He was on his feet, checking his pockets for wallet and keys, when he became aware of Robin's slight air of dejection, though she was continuing to pore over the unincriminating photographs.
Do you want to come?
Yes, she said gleefully, seizing her handbag and closing down her computer.
Chapter 3. The heavy, black-painted front door of number 18 Kentigern Gardens opened onto a marbled lobby. Directly opposite the entrance was a handsome built-in mahogany desk, to the right of which was the staircase, which turned immediately out of sight, marble steps with a brass and wood handrail. The entrance to the lift, with its burnished gold doors and a solid dark wood door set into the white-painted wall. On a white cubic display unit in the corner between this and the front doors was a vast display of deep pink oriental lilies in tall tubular vases, their scent heavy on the warm air. The left-hand wall was mirrored, doubling the apparent size of the space, reflecting the staring Strike and Robin. The lift doors and the modern chandelier hung in cubes of crystal overhead, and lengthening the security desk to a vast stretch of polished wood. Strike remembered Wardle.
Flats done up with marble and shit like a fucking 5-star hotel.
Beside him, Robin was trying not to look impressed. This, then, was how multimillionaires lived. She and Matthew occupied the lower floor of a semi-detached house in Clapham. Its sitting room was the same size as that designated for the off-duty guards, which Wilson showed them first. There was just enough room for a table and 2 chairs. A wall-mounted box contained all the master keys, and another door led into a tiny toilet cubicle. Wilson was wearing a black uniform that was constabular in design, with its brass buttons, black tie, and white shirt.
Monitors,
he pointed out to Strike, as they emerged from the back room and paused behind the desk, where a row of 4 small black-and-white screens was hidden from guests. One showed footage from the camera over the front door, affording a circumscribed view of the street. Another displayed a similarly deserted view of an underground car park. A third, the empty back garden of number 18, which comprised lawn, some fancy planting, and the high back wall Strike had hoisted himself up on. And the fourth, the interior of the stationary lift. In addition to the monitors, there were 2 control panels for the communal alarms and those for the doors into the pool and car park, and 2 telephones, one attached to an outside line, the other connected only to the 3 flats.
That, said Wilson, indicating the solid wooden door, goes to the gym, the pool and the car park.
And at Strike's request, he led them through it. The gym was small, but mirrored like the lobby, so that it appeared twice as big. It had 1 window facing the street, and contained a treadmill, rowing and step machines, and a set of weights. A second mahogany door led to a narrow marble stair, lit by cubic wall lights, which took them onto a small lower landing, where a plain painted door led to the underground car park. Wilson opened it with two keys, a Chubb and a Yale, then flicked a switch. The floodlit area was almost as long as the street itself, full of millions of pounds worth of Ferrari, Audi, Bentley, Jaguar, and BMW. At 20-foot intervals along the back wall were doors like the one through which they had just come, inner entrances to each of the houses of Kentigern Gardens. The electric garage doors leading from Surf's Way were close by number 18, outlined by silvery daylight. Robin wondered what the silent men beside her were thinking. Was Wilson used to the extraordinary lives of the people who lived here? Used to underground car parks and swimming pools and Ferraris? And was Strike thinking, as she was, that this long row of doors represented possibilities she had not once considered? Chances of secret hidden scurrying between neighbours, and of hiding and departing in as many ways as there were houses in the street. But then she noticed the numerous black snouts pointing from regular spots on the shadowy upper walls, feeding footage back to countless monitors. Was it possible that none of them had been watched that night?
"Okay," said Strike.
And Wilson led them back onto the marble staircase and locked up the car park door behind them. Down another short flight of stairs, the smell of chlorine became stronger with every step, until Wilson opened a door at the bottom and they were assailed by a wave of warm, damp, chemically laden air.
"This is the door that wasn't locked that night?" Strike asked Wilson, who nodded as he pressed another switch and light blazed.
They had walked onto the broad marble rim of the pool, which was shielded by a thick plastic cover. The opposite wall was again mirrored. Robin saw the three of them standing there, incongruous in full dress, against a mural of tropical plants and fluttering butterflies that extended up over the ceiling. The pool was around 15 meters long, and at the far end was a hexagonal jacuzzi, beyond which were three changing cubicles, fronted by lockable doors.
"No cameras here?" asked Strike, looking around. And Wilson shook his head.
Robin could feel sweat prickling on the back of her neck and under her arms. It was oppressive in the pool area, and she was pleased to climb the stairs ahead of the two men back to the lobby, which in comparison was pleasant and airy. A petite young blonde had appeared in their absence, wearing a pink overall, jeans and a T-shirt, and carrying a plastic bucket full of cleaning implements.
"Derek,"
she said, in heavily accented English, when a security guard emerged from downstairs.
"I need key for two."
"This is Lexinka," said Wilson, "the cleaner."
She favoured Robin and Strike with a small, sweet smile. Wilson moved around behind the mahogany desk and handed her a key from beneath it, and Lexinka then ascended the stairs, her bucket swinging, her tightly bejeaned backside swelling and swaying seductively. Strike, conscious of Robin's sideways glance, withdrew his gaze from it reluctantly. Strike and Robin followed Wilson upstairs to flat one, which he opened up with a master key. The door onto the stairwell, Strike noted, had an old-fashioned peephole.
"Mr. Bestiguis, please," announced Wilson,
stifling the alarm by entering the code on a pad to the right of the door.
"Lexinka's already been in this morning."
Strike could smell polish and see the track marks of a vacuum cleaner on the white carpet of the hallway, with its brass wall lights and its five immaculate white doors. He noticed the discreet alarm keypad on the right wall at right angles to a painting in which dreamy goats and peasants floated over a blue-toned village. Tall vases of orchids stood on a black Japan table beneath the shagal.
"Where's Bestigui?" Strike asked Wilson.
"L.A.," said the security guard. "Back in 2 days."
The light, bright sitting room had three tall windows, each of them with a shallow stone balcony beyond. Its walls were Wedgwood blue, and nearly everything else was white. All was pristine, elegant, and beautifully proportioned. Here, too, there was a single superb painting, macabre, surreal, with a spear-bearing man masked as a blackbird, arm in arm with a grey-toned, headless female torso. It was from this room that Tansy Bastigui maintained she had heard a screaming match two floors above. Strike moved up close to the long windows, noting the modern catches, the thickness of the panes, the complete lack of noise from the street, though his ear was barely half an inch from the cold glass. The balcony beyond was narrow, and filled with potted shrubs, trimmed into pointed cones. Strike moved off towards the bedroom. Robin remained in the sitting room, turning slowly where she stood, taking in the chandelier of Venetian glass, the muted rug in shades of pale blue and pink, the enormous plasma TV, the modern glass and iron dining table, and silk-cushioned iron chairs, the small silver objet d'art on glass side tables and on the white marble mantelpiece. She thought a little sadly of the IKEA sofa of which she had, until now, felt so proud. Then she remembered Strike's camp bed in the office with a twinge of shame. Catching Wilson's eye, she said, unconsciously echoing Eric Wardle,
"It's a different world, isn't it?"
"Yeah," he said. "You couldn't have kids in here."
"No," said Robin, who had not considered the place from that point of view. Her employer strode out of the bedroom, evidently absorbed in establishing some point to his own satisfaction, and disappeared into the hall. Strike was, in fact, proving to himself that the logical route from the Bastigui's bedroom to their bathroom was through the hall, bypassing the sitting room altogether. Furthermore, it was his belief that the only place in the flat from which Tansy could conceivably have witnessed the fatal fall of Lula Landry and realized what she was seeing was from the sitting room. In spite of Eric Wardle's assertion to the contrary, nobody standing in the bathroom could have had more than a partial view of the window past which Landry had fallen. Insufficient, at night, to be sure that whatever had fallen was a human, let alone to identify which human it had been. Strike returned to the bedroom. Now that he was in solitary possession of the marital home, Bastigui was sleeping on the side nearest the door in the hall, judging by the clutter of pills, glasses, and books piled on that bedside table. Strike wondered whether this had been the case while he cohabited with his wife. A large walk-in wardrobe with mirrored doors led off the bedroom. It was full of Italian suits and shirts from Turnbull and Asser. Two shallow, subdivided drawers were devoted entirely to cufflinks in gold and platinum. There was a safe behind a false panel at the back of the shoe racks.
"I think that's everything in here," Strike told Wilson, rejoining the other two in the sitting room.
Wilson set the alarm when they left the flat.
"You know all the codes for the different flats?"
"Yeah," said Wilson. "Gutter, in case they go off."
They climbed the stairs to the second floor. The staircase turned so tightly around the lift shaft that it was a succession of blind corners. The door to flat two was identical to that of flat one, except that it was standing ajar. They could hear the growl of Lexinka's vacuum cleaner from inside.
"We got Mr. and Mrs. Kolchak in here now," said Wilson. "Ukrainian."
The hallway was identical in shape to that of number one, with many of the same features, including the alarm keypad in the wall at right angles to the front door. But it was tiled instead of carpeted. A large gilt mirror faced the entrance instead of a painting, and two fragile, spindly wooden tables on either side of it bore ornate Tiffany lamps.
"Were Bastigui's roses on something like that?" asked Strike. "On one that's just like 'em, yeah," said Wilson. "It's back in the lounge now." "And you put it here in the middle of the hall with the roses on it?" "Yeah. Bastigui wanted Mac to see 'em soon as he walked in, but there was plenty of room to walk around 'em, you can see that. No need to knock 'em over. But he was young, the copper.
said Wilson tolerantly.
"Where are the panic buttons you told me about?"
Strike asked.
"Round here," said Wilson, leading him out of the hall and into the bedroom. "There's one by the bed, and there's another one in the sitting room."
"Have all the flats got these?"
"Yeah."
The relative positions of the bedrooms, sitting room, kitchen and bathroom were identical to those of flat one. Many of the finishings were similar, down to the mirrored doors in the walk-in wardrobe, which Strike went to check. While he was opening the doors and surveying the thousands of pounds worth of women's dresses and coats, Lexinka emerged from the bedroom with a belt, two ties, and several polythene-covered dresses, fresh from the dry cleaners, over her arm.
"Hi," said Strike.
"Hello,"
she said, moving to a door behind him and pulling out a tie rack.
"Excuse, please."
He stood aside. She was short and very pretty in a pert, girlish way, with a rather flat face, a snub nose, and Slavic eyes. She hung up the ties neatly while he watched her.
"I'm a detective," he said.
Then he remembered that Eric Wardle had described her English as crap.
"Like a policeman,"
he ventured.
"Ah, police!
You were here, weren't you, the day before Lula Landry died?"
It took a few tries to convey exactly what he meant. When she grasped the point, however, she showed no objection to answering questions, as long as she could continue putting the clothes away as she talked.
"I always clean stair first," she said. "Miss Landry is talking very loud at her brother. He's shouting that she gives boyfriend too much monies, and she very bad with him. I clean number two, empty. It's clean already, quick."
"Were Derek and the man from the security firm there while you were cleaning?"
"Derek and..."
"The repairman. The alarm man."
"Yes, alarm man and Derek, yes."
Strike could hear Robin and Wilson talking in the hall where he had left them.
"Do you set the alarms again after you've cleaned?"
"Put alarm?
Yes," she said. 1966, same as door, Derek tells me."
"He told you the number before he left with the alarm man."
Again, it took a few tries to get the point across, and when she grasped it, she seemed impatient.
"Yes, I already say this, 1966.
"So you set the alarm after you'd finished cleaning in here?"
"Put alarm, yes."
"And the alarm man, what did he look like?"
"Alarm man, look?"
She frowned attractively, her small nose wrinkling, and shrugged.
"I not see his face, but blue. All blue," she added.
And with the hand not holding polythene dresses, she made a sweeping gesture down her body.
"Overall?"
he suggested. But she met the word with blank incomprehension.
"Okay, where did you clean after that?"
"Number one,"
said Lexinka, returning to her task of hanging up the clothes, moving around him to find the correct rails.
"Clean big windows. Miss Bestigui talking on telephone. Angry, upset. She say she no want to lie no more."
"She didn't want to lie," repeated Strike.
Lexinka nodded, standing on tiptoes to hang up a floor-length gown.
"You heard her say," he repeated clearly, "on the phone, that she didn't want to lie any more."
Lexinka nodded again, her face blank, innocent.
"Then she see me, and she shout, 'Go away, go away!'"
"Really?"
Lexinka nodded and continued to put away clothes.
"Where was Mr. Bestigui?"
"Not there."
"Do you know who she was speaking to? On the phone?"
"No."
But then a little slyly she said,
"Woman."
"A woman? How do you know?" "Shouting, shouting on telephone. I can hear woman."
"It was a row, an argument?"
"They were yelling at each other. Loud. Yeah?"
Strike could hear himself lapsing into the absurd, over-deliberate language of the linguistically challenged Englishman.
Lexinka nodded again as she pulled open drawers in search of the place for the belt, the only item now remaining in her arms. When at last she had coiled it up and put it away, she straightened and walked away from him into the bedroom. He followed. While she made the bed and neatened the bedside tables, he established that she had cleaned Lula Landry's flat last that day, after the model had left to visit her mother. She had noticed nothing out of the ordinary, nor had she spotted any blue writing paper, whether written on or blank. Guisame's handbags and the various items for D.B. Mack had been delivered to the security desk by the time she had finished, and the last thing she had done at work that day had been to take the designer's gifts up to Lula's and Mack's respective flats.
"And you set the alarms again after putting the things in there?"
"I put alarms, yes."
"Lula's?"
"Yes."
"And 1966 in flat 2?
"Yes."
"Can you remember what you put away in D.B. Mack's flat?"
She had to mime some of the items, but she managed to convey that she remembered two tops, a belt, a hat, some gloves, and, she made a fiddling mime around her wrists, cufflinks. After stowing these things in the open shelving area of the walk-in wardrobe, so that Mack could not miss them, she had reset the alarm and gone home. Strike thanked her very much, and lingered just long enough to admire once more her tightly denimed backside as she straightened the duvet before rejoining Robin and Wilson in the hall. As they proceeded up the third flight of stairs, Strike checked Lexinka's story with Wilson, who agreed that he had instructed the repairman to set the alarm to 1966, like the front door.
"I just chose a number that'd be easy for Lexinka to remember because of the front door. Mack could have reset it to something different if he'd wanted."
"Can you remember what the repairman looked like? You said he was new."
"Really young guy, hair to here."
Wilson indicated the base of his neck.
"White?"
"Yeah, white. Didn't even look like he was shaving yet."
They had reached the front door of flat 3, once the home of Lula Landry. Robin felt a frisson of something. Fear, excitement, as Wilson opened the third smoothly painted white front door with its glassy bullet-sized peephole. The top flat was architecturally different from the other two, smaller and airier. It had been recently decorated throughout in shades of cream and brown. Guy Sommet had told Strike that the flat's famous previous inhabitant loved colour, but it was now as impersonal as any upmarket hotel room. Strike led the way in silence to the sitting room. The carpet here was not lush and woolen, as in Bestigui's flat, but made of rough sand-coloured jute. Strike ran his heel across it. It made no mark or track.
"Was the floor like this when Lula lived here?"
he asked Wilson.
"Yeah, she chose it. It was nearly new, so they left it."
Instead of the regularly spaced long windows of the lower flats, each with three separate small balconies, the penthouse flat boasted a single pair of double doors leading onto one wide balcony. Strike unlocked and opened these doors and stepped outside. Robin did not like watching him do it. After a glance at Wilson's impassive face, she turned and stared at the cushions and the black and white prints, trying not to think about what had happened here 3 months previously. Strike was looking down into the street, and Robin might have been surprised to know that his thoughts were not as clinical or dispassionate as she supposed. He was visualizing someone who had lost control completely, someone running at Landry as she stood, fine-boned and beautiful, in the outfit she had thrown on to meet a much-anticipated guest. A killer lost in rage, half-dragging, half-pushing her, and finally, with the brute strength of a highly motivated maniac, throwing her. The seconds it took her to fall through the air towards the concrete, smothered in its deceptively soft covering of snow, must have seemed to last an eternity. She had flailed, trying to find handholds in the merciless empty air, and then, without time to make amends, to explain, to bequeath, or to apologize,
without any of the luxuries permitted those who were given notice of their impending demise. She had broken on the road. The dead could only speak through the mouths of those left behind, and through the signs they left scattered behind them. Strike had felt the living woman behind the words she had written to friends. He had heard her voice on a telephone held to his ear. But now, looking down on the last thing she had ever seen in her life, he felt strangely close to her. The truth was coming slowly into focus out of the mass of disconnected detail. What he lacked was proof. His mobile phone rang as he stood there. John Bristow's name and number were displayed. He took the call.
"Hi, John. Thanks for getting back to me."
"No problem. Any news?" asked the lawyer.
"Maybe. I've had an expert look at Lula's laptop, and he found out a file of photographs had been deleted from it after Lula died. Do you know anything about that?"
His words were met by complete silence. The only reason Strike knew that they had not been cut off was that he could hear a small amount of background noise at Bristow's end. At last the lawyer said, in an altered voice, "They were taken off after Lula died."
"That's what the expert says."
Strike watched a car roll slowly down the street below and pause halfway along. A woman got out, swathed in fur.
I'm sorry," Bristow said, sounding thoroughly shaken. "I'm just shocked. Perhaps the police removed this file."
"When did you get the laptop back from them?"
"Oh, sometime in February, I suppose. Early February."
"This file was removed on March the 17th.
But this just doesn't make sense. Nobody knew the password."
"Well, evidently somebody did. You said the police told your mother what it was."
"My mother certainly wouldn't have removed."
"I'm not suggesting she did. Is there any chance she could have left the laptop open and running? Or that she gave somebody else the password?"
He thought that Bristow must be in his office. He could hear faint voices in the background, and distantly, a woman laughing.
"I suppose that's possible," said Bristow slowly. "But who would have removed photographs? Unless... But God, that's horrible."
"What is?"
"You don't think one of the nurses could have taken the pictures? To sell to a newspaper? But that's a dreadful thought. A nurse.
All the expert knows is that they were deleted. There's no evidence that they were copied and stolen. But as you say, anything's possible."
"But who else... I mean, naturally, I hate to think it could be a nurse, but who else could it be? The laptop's been at my mother's ever since the police gave it back."
"John, are you aware of every visitor your mother's had in the last 3 months?"
"I think so. I mean, obviously, I can't be sure."
"No. Well, there's the difficulty."
"But why? Why would anyone do this?"
"I can think of a few reasons. It would be a big help if you could ask your mother about this, though, John. Whether she had the laptop running in mid-March, whether any of her visitors expressed an interest in it."
I'll try."
Bristow sounded very stressed, almost tearful.
"She's very, very weak now."
"I'm sorry," said Strike formally. "I'll be in touch shortly. Bye."
He stepped back from the balcony and closed the doors, then turned to Wilson.
"Derek, can you show me how you searched this place? What order you looked in the rooms that night?"
Wilson thought for a moment, then said,
"I come in here first, looked around, seen the doors open. Didn't touch them. Then," he indicated that they should follow him, "I looked in here."
Robin, following in the two men's wake, noticed a subtle change in the way that Strike was talking to the security man. He was asking simple, deft questions, focusing on what Wilson had felt, touched, seen and heard at each step of his way through the flat. Under Strike's guidance, Wilson's body language started to change. He began to enact the way he had held the door jams, leaning into rooms, casting a rapid look around. When he crossed to the only bedroom, he did it at a slow-motion run, responding to the spotlight of Strike's undivided attention. He dropped to his knees to demonstrate how he had looked under the bed, and at Strike's prompting, remembered that a dress had lain crumpled beneath his legs. He led them, face set with concentration, to the bathroom, and showed them how he had swiveled to check behind the door before sprinting. He almost mimed it, arms moving exaggeratedly as he walked, back to the front door.
"And then," said Strike, opening it and gesturing Wilson through, "you came out."
"I came out," agreed Wilson, in his bass voice, "and I jabbed the lift button."
He pretended to do it, and feigned pushing open the doors in his anxiety to see what was inside.
"Nothing. So I started running back down again."
"What could you hear now?"
Strike asked, following him. Neither of them were paying any attention to Robin, who closed the flat door behind her.
"Very distant. The Bestiguis yelling, and I turned around this corner and..."
Wilson stopped dead on the stair. Strike, who seemed to have anticipated something like this, stopped too. Robin careered straight into him, with a flustered apology that he cut off with a raised hand, as though, she thought, Wilson was in a trance.
"And I slipped," said Wilson.
He sounded shocked.
"I forgot that. I slipped, here, backwards, sat down hard. There was water, here, drops, here."
He was pointing at the stairs.
"Drops of water," repeated Strike. "Yeah. Not snow. No. Not wet footprints. Drops, big drops here. Me foot skidded and I slipped, and I just got up and kept running."
"Did you tell the police about the drops of water?"
"No, I forgot. Till now, I forgot."
Something that had bothered Strike all along had at last been made clear. He let out a great satisfied sigh and grinned. The other two stared. Chapter 4. The weekend stretched ahead, warm and empty. Strike sat at his open window again, smoking and watching the hordes of shoppers passing along Denmark Street, the case report open on his lap, the police file on the desk, making a list for himself of points still to be clarified, and sifting the morass of information he had collected. For a while, he contemplated a photograph of the front of number 18, as it had been on the morning after Lula died. There was a small, but to Strike, significant difference between the frontage as it had been then and as it was now. From time to time, he moved to the computer. Once to find out the agent who represented D.B. Mack, then to look at the share price for Albris. His notebook lay open beside him at a full page of truncated sentences and questions, all in his dense, spiky handwriting. When his mobile rang, he raised it to his ear without checking who was on the other end.
"Ah, oh, Mr. Strike," said Peter Gillespie's voice. "How nice of you to pick up."
"Oh, hello, Peter," said Strike. "Got you working weekends now, has he?"
"Some of us have no option but to work at weekends. You haven't returned any of my weekday phone calls."
"I've been busy, working."
"I see. Does that mean we can expect a repayment soon?"
"I expect so."
"You expect so?"
"Yeah," said Strike. "I should be in a position to give you something in the next few weeks."
"Mr. Strike, your attitude astounds me. You undertook to repay Mr. Rokeby monthly, and you are now in arrears to the tune of... I can't pay you what I haven't got. If you hold tight, I should be able to give you all of it back. Maybe even in a wanna. I'm afraid that simply isn't good enough. Unless you bring these repayments up to date..." "Gillespie," said Strike, his eyes on the bright sky beyond the window. "We both know old Johnny isn't going to sue his one-legged war hero's son for a repayment of a loan that wouldn't keep his butler in fucking bath salts. I'll give him back his money with interest within the next couple of months,
and he can stick it up his arse and set fire to it if he likes. Tell him that from me, and now get off my fucking back."
Strike hung up, interested to note that he had not really lost his temper at all, but still felt mildly cheerful. He worked on, in what he had come to think of as Robin's chair, late into the night. The last thing he did before turning in was to underline three times the words "Malmaison Hotel, Oxford," and to circle in heavy ink the name J.P. Aguman. The country was lumbering towards election day. Strike turned in early on Sunday and watched the day's gaffes, counterclaims and promises being tabulated on his portable TV. There was an air of joylessness in every news report he watched. The national debt was so huge that it was difficult to comprehend. Cuts were coming, whoever won. Deep, painful cuts. And sometimes, with their weasel words, the party leaders reminded Strike of the surgeons who had told him cautiously that he might experience a degree of discomfort. They who would never personally feel the pain that was about to be inflicted. On Monday morning, Strike set out for a rendezvous in Canning Town, where he was to meet Marlene Higson, Lula Landry's biological mother. The arrangement of this interview had been fraught with difficulty. Bristow's secretary, Allison, had telephoned Robin with Marlene Higson's number, and Strike had called her personally. Though clearly disappointed that the stranger on the phone was not a journalist, she had initially expressed herself willing to meet Strike. She had then called the office back twice, firstly to ask Robin whether the detective would pay her expenses to travel into the centre of town, to which a negative answer was given, next, in high dudgeon, to cancel the meeting. A second call from Strike had secured a tentative agreement to meet in her local pub, then an irritable voicemail message cancelled once more. Strike had then telephoned her for a third time, and told her that he believed his investigation to be in its final phase, after which evidence would be laid to the police, resulting, he had no doubt, in a further explosion of publicity. Now that he came to think about it, he said, if she was unable to help, it might be just as well for her to be protected from another deluge of press inquiry. Marlene Higson had immediately clamoured for her right to tell everything she knew, and Strike condescended to meet her, as she had already suggested, in the beer garden of the Ordnance Arms on Monday morning. He took the train out to Canning Town Station. It was overlooked by Canary Wharf, whose sleek, futuristic buildings resembled a series of gleaming metal blocks on the horizon. Their size, like that of the national debt, impossible to gauge from such a distance. But a few minutes' walk later, he was as far from the shining, suited corporate world as it was possible to be. Crammed up alongside dockside developments, where many of those financiers lived in neat designer pods, Canning Town exhaled poverty and deprivation. Strike knew it of old, because it had once been home to the old friend who had given him Brett Fearney's location. Down Barking Road he walked, his back to Canary Wharf, past a building with a sign that advertised "Kills for Communities," at which he frowned for a moment before realizing that somebody had swiped the S. The Ordnance Arms sat beside the English Pawnbroking Company Limited. It was a large, low-slung, off-white-painted pub. The interior was no-nonsense and utilitarian, with a selection of wooden clocks on a terracotta-coloured wall, and a lividly patterned piece of red carpet, the only gesture to anything as frivolous as decoration. Otherwise, there were two large pool tables, a long and accessible bar, and plenty of empty space for milling drinkers. Just now, at 11 in the morning, it was empty except for one little old man in the corner and a cheery serving girl who addressed her only customer as Joey and gave Strike directions through the back. The beer garden turned out to be the grimmest of concrete backyards, containing bins and a solitary wooden table at which a woman was sitting on a white plastic chair with her fat legs crossed and her cigarette held at right angles to her cheek. There was barbed wire on top of the high wall, and a plastic bag had caught in it and was rustling in the breeze. Beyond the wall there rose a vast block of flats, yellow-painted and with evidence of squalor bulging over many of the balconies.
"Mrs. Hickson? Call me Marlene, love."
She looked him up and down with a slack smile and a knowing gaze. She was wearing a pink lycra vest top under a zip-up grey hoodie and leggings that ended inches above her bare grey-white ankles. There were grubby flip-flops on her feet and many gold rings on her fingers. Her yellow hair, with its inches of greying brown root, was pulled back into a dirty, toweling scrunchie.
"Can I get you a drink?"
"I'll have a pint of Carlin if you twist my arm."
The way she bent her body towards him, the way she pushed straw-like strands of hair out of her pouchy eyes, even the way she held her cigarette, all were grotesquely coquettish. Perhaps she knew no other way of relating to anything male. Strike found her simultaneously pathetic and repulsive.
"Shock,"
said Marlene Higson, after Strike had bought them both beer and joined her at the table.
"You can say that again. When I'd gave her up for lost, it nearly broke my heart when she went, but I thought I was giving her a better life. I wouldn't have had the strength to do it otherwise. Thought I was giving her all the things I never had. I grew up poor, proper poor. We had nothing, nothing."
She looked away from him, drawing hard on her Rothmans. When her mouth puckered into hard little lines around the cigarette, it looked like a cat's anus.
"And there's me boyfriend, see? He wasn't too keen. You know, with her being coloured, it were obvious she weren't his. They go darker, see? When she were born, she looked white. But I still never wouldn't have given her up, if I hadn't seen a chance for her to get a better life. And I thought, she won't miss me, she's too young. I gave her a good start, and maybe when she's older she'll come and find me. And me dream come true," she added, with a ghastly show of pathos. "She come and found me." "I'll tell you something really strange, right?" she said, without drawing breath. "A man friend of mine says to me, just a week before I got the call from her, 'You know who you look like,' he says. I says, 'Don't be so silly.' But he says, 'Straight up, across the eyes, and the shape of the eyebrows, you know?'"
She looked hopefully at Strike, who could not bring himself to respond. It seemed impossible that the face of Nefertiti could have sprung from this grey and purple mess.
"You can see it in photos of me when I were younger," she said, with a hint of pique. "Point is, I thought I was giving her a better life, and then they went and give her to those bastards, pardon my language. If I'd have known, I'd have kept her, and I told her that. That made her cry. I'd have kept her and never let her go. Oh, yeah, she talked to me. It all poured out. She got on all right with the father, with Sralik. He sounded all right. The mother's a right mad bitch, though. Oh, yeah. Pills. Popping pills. Fucking rich bitches taking pills for their fucking nerves. Lula could talk to me, see? Well, it's a bond, isn't it? You can't break it. Blood. She was scared what that bitch would do if she found out Lula was looking for her real mum. She was proper worried about what the cow was going to do when the press found out about me. But there you are. When you're famous like she was, they find out everything, don't they? Oh, the lies they tell, though. Some of the things they said about me. I'm still thinking of suing. What was I saying? Her mother, yeah. I says to Lula, 'Why worry, love? Sounds to me like you're better off without her anyway. Let her be pissed off if she don't want us to see each other.' But she was a good girl, Lula, and she kept visiting her out of duty. Anyway, she had her own life. She was free to do what she wanted, weren't she? She had Evan, a man of her own. I told her I disapproved, mind," said Marlene Higson, with a pantomime of strictness. "Oh, yeah, drugs. I've seen too many go that way. But I have to admit, he's a sweet boy underneath. I have to admit that. He didn't have nothing to do with it, I can tell you that."
"Met him, did you?"
"No, but she called him once while she was with me, and I heard him on the phone together, and they were a lovely couple. Nah, I got nothing bad to say about Evan. He had nothing to do with it, that's proved. Nah, I've got nothing bad to say about him.
As long as he'd have gone clean, he'd have had my blessing. I said to her, bring him along, see whether I approve, but she never. He was always busy. He's a lovely-looking boy, under all that air, said Marlene. You can see it in all his photos.
Did she talk to you about her neighbours?
Oh, that Fred B. Stweegee. Yeah, she told me all about him offering her parts in his films. I said to her, why not? It might be a laugh. Even if she hadn't liked it, it would have been, what, another half mil in a bank?
Her bloodshot eyes squinted at nothing. She seemed momentarily mesmerised, lost in contemplation of some so vast and dazzling that they were beyond her ken, like an image of infinity. Merely to speak of them was to taste the power of money, to roll dreams of wealth around her mouth.
Did you ever hear her talk about Guy Sommet?
Oh, yes, she liked Guy. He was good to her. Personally, I prefer more classic things. It's not my kind of style.
The shocking pink lycra, tight on the rolls of fat spilling over the waistband of her leggings, rippled as she leaned forward to tap her cigarette delicately into the ashtray.
"He's like a brother to me," she says. And I says, "Never mind pretend brothers, why don't we try and find my boys together?"
But she weren't interested.
"Your boys?"
"Me sons, me other kids. Yeah, I had two more after her, one with Des, and then later there was another one. Social services took them off me, but I says to her, with your money we could find them. Give me a bit, not much, I dunno, couple of grand, and I'll try and get someone to find them. Keep it quiet from the press. I'll handle it. I'll keep you out of it."
"But she weren't interested," repeated Marlene.
"Do you know where your sons are?"
"They took them as babies. I dunno where they are now. I was having problems. I ain't gonna lie to you. I've had a bloody hard life."
And she told him, at length, about her hard life. It was a sordid story littered with violent men, with addiction and ignorance, neglect and poverty, and an animal instinct for survival that jettisoned babies in its wake, for they demanded skills that Marlene had never developed.
"So you don't know where your two sons are now?" Strike repeated, 20 minutes later.
"No, how the fuck could I?"
said Marlene, who had talked herself into bitterness.
"She weren't interested anyway. She already had a white brother, didn't she? She was after black family. That's what she really wanted."
"Did she ask you about her father?"
"Yeah, and I told her everything I knew. He was an African student. Lived upstairs from me, just along the road here, Barking Road, with two others. There's the bookies downstairs now. Very good-looking boy. Helped me with shopping a couple of times."
To hear Marlene Higson tell it, the courtship had proceeded with an almost Victorian respectability. She and the African student seemed barely to have progressed past handshakes during the first months of their acquaintance.
"And then, 'cause he'd helped me all them times, one day I asked him in, you know, just as a thank you, really. I'm not a prejudiced person. Everyone's the same to me. Fancy a cuppa, I says, that were all. And then," said Marlene, harsh reality clanging down amidst the vague impressions of teacups and doilies, "I finds out I'm expecting."
"Did you tell him?"
"Oh, yeah. And he was full of how he was going to help and shoulder his responsibilities and make sure I was all right. And then it was the college holidays. He said he was coming back," said Marlene contemptuously. "Then he ran a mile, don't they all? And what was I going to do? Run off to Africa to find him?" "It was no skin off my nose, anyway. I wasn't breaking me heart. I was seeing Des by then. He didn't mind the baby. I moved in with Des not long after Joe left."
"Joe?"
"That was his name. Joe."
She said it with conviction, but perhaps, thought Strike, that was because she had repeated the lie so often that the story had become easy, automatic.
"What was his surname?"
"I can't fucking remember." "You're like her. It was 20-odd years ago. Mamumba," said Marlene Higson, unabashed. "Or something like that."
"Could it have been Aguman?"
No. A woozoo?
I told you, she said aggressively. It were Mamumba or something.
Not MacDonald or Wilson?
You taking a piss? MacDonald, Wilson, from Africa?
Strike concluded that her relationship with the African had never progressed to the exchange of surnames. And he was a student, you said. Where was he studying?
College, said Marlene.
Which one, can you remember?
I don't bloody know. All right if I catch a ciggy,
she added, in a slightly more conciliatory tone.
Yeah, help yourself.
She lit her cigarette with her own plastic lighter, puffed enthusiastically, then said, mellowed by the free tobacco,
It might have been something to do with a museum. Attached, like.
Attached to a museum?
Yeah, 'cause I remember him saying, I sometimes visit the museum in my free hours.
Her imitation made the African student sound like an upper-class Englishman. She was smirking, as though this choice of recreation was absurd, ludicrous.
Can you remember which museum it was that he visited?
The Museum of England or something, she said.
And then, irritably,
You're like her. How the fuck am I supposed to remember after all this time?
And you never saw him again after he went home?
Nope, she said. I wasn't expecting to.
She drank lager.
He's probably dead, she said.
Why do you say that?
Africa, innit, she said. He could have been shot, couldn't he? Or starved, anything. You know what it's like out there.
Strike did know. He remembered the teeming streets of Nairobi, the aerial view of Angola's rainforest, mist hanging over the treetops, and the sudden breathtaking beauty, as the chopper turned, of a waterfall in the lush green mountainside. And the Maasai woman, baby at her breast, sitting on a box while Strike questioned her painstakingly about alleged rape, and Tracy manned the video camera beside him.
Do you know whether Lula tried to find her father?
Yeah, she tried, said Marlene dismissively.
How?
She looked up college records, said Marlene.
But if you couldn't remember where he went...
I don't know, she thought she found a place or something, but she couldn't find him, no. Maybe I wasn't remembering his name right, I don't know. She used to go on and fucking on. What did he look like? Where was he studying? I said to her, he was tall and skinny, and you want to be grateful you got my ears, not his. Because there wouldn't have been no fucking modelling career if you got them fucking elephant lugs.
Did Lula ever talk to you about her friends?
Oh, yeah. There was that little black bitch, Raquel, or whatever she called herself, leeching all she could out of Lula. Oh, she did herself all right. Fucking clothes and jewellery and I don't know what the fuck else. I says to Lula once, I wouldn't mind a new coat. But I wasn't pushy, see. That Raquel didn't mind asking.
She sniffed and drained her glass.
Did you ever meet Rochelle?
That was her name, was it? Yeah, once. She come along in a fucking car with a driver to pick Lula up from seeing me. Like Lady Muck out the back window, sneering at me. She'll be missing all of that now, I expect. In it for all she could get. And there was that Kiara Porter,
Marlene ploughed on, with, if possible, even greater spite, sleeping with Lula's boyfriend the night she fucking died, nasty fucking bitch.
Do you know Kiara Porter?
I seen it in the fucking papers. He went off to her place, didn't he, Evan, after he rowed with Lula, went to Kiara, fucking bitch.
It became clear, as Marlene talked on, that Lula had kept her natural mother firmly segregated from her friends, and that, with the exception of a brief glimpse of Rochelle, Marlene's opinions and deductions about Lula's social set were based entirely on the press reports she had greedily consumed. Strike fetched more drinks, and listened to Marlene describe the horror and shock she had experienced on hearing, from the neighbour who had run in with the news early in the morning of the 8th, that her daughter had fallen to her death from her balcony. Careful questioning revealed that Lula had not seen Marlene for 2 months before she died. Strike then listened to a diatribe about the treatment she had received from Lula's adoptive family following the model's death.
They didn't want me around, especially that fucking uncle. Have you met him, have you? Fucking Tony Landry? I contacted him about the funeral and all I got was threats. Oh, yeah, fucking threats. I said to him, I'm her mother. I've got a right to be there. And he told me I wasn't her mother. That mad bitch was her mother, Lady Bristow. Funny, I says, because I remember pushing her out of my fanny. Sorry for my crudity, but there you are. And he said I was causing distress, talking to the press. They come and found me, she told Strike furiously, and she jabbed her finger at the block of flats overlooking them. Press, come and found me. Course I told my side of the fucking story, course I did. Well, I didn't want a scene, not at a funeral. I didn't want to ruin things, but I wasn't going to be kept away. I went and sat at the back. I seen fucking Rochelle there giving me looks like I was dirt, but nobody stopped me in the end. They got what they wanted, that fucking family. I didn't get nothing. Nothing. That's not what Lula would have wanted. I know that for a fact. She would have wanted me to have something. Not, said Marlene, with an assumption of dignity, that I cared about the money. It weren't about the money for me. Nothing was going to replace my daughter. Not 10, not 20 mil. Mind you, she'd have been livid if she'd known I didn't get nothing, she went on. All that money going begging. People can't believe it when I tell them I got nothing. Struggling to make the rent, and me own daughter left millions. But there you are. That's how the rich stay rich, ain't it? They didn't need it, but they didn't mind a bit more. I don't know how that Landry sleeps at night, but that's his business.
Did Lula ever tell you she was going to leave you anything? Did she mention having made a will? Marlene seemed suddenly alert to a whiff of hope.
Oh, yeah. She said she'd look after me, yeah, yeah. She told me she'd see me all right. Do you think I should have told someone that? Mentioned it, like?
I don't think it would have made any difference, unless she made a will and left you something in it, said Strike.
Her face fell back into its sullen expression. They probably fucking destroyed it, them bastards. They could have done. That's the sort of people they are. I wouldn't put nothing past that uncle.
Chapter 5
I'm so sorry he hasn't got back to you, Robin told the caller, 7 miles away in the office. Mr. Strike's incredibly busy at the moment. Let me take your name and number, and I'll make sure he phones you this afternoon.
Oh, there's no need for that, said the woman. She had a pleasant, cultivated voice, with a faint suspicion of hoarseness, as though her laugh would be sexy and bold. I don't really need to speak to him. Could you just give him a message for me? I wanted to warn him, that's all. God, this is... it's a bit embarrassing. It isn't the way I'd have chosen. Well, anyway. Could you please just tell him that Charlotte Campbell called and that I'm engaged to Jago Ross? I didn't want him to hear about it from anyone else or read about it. Jago's parents have gone and put it in the bloody Times. Mortifying. Oh, all right, said Robin. Her mind suddenly paralysed like her pen. Thanks very much. Robin, did you say? Thanks. Bye.
Charlotte rang off first. Robin replaced the receiver in slow motion, feeling acutely anxious. She did not want to deliver this news. She might be only the messenger, but she would feel as though she were delivering an assault on Strike's determination to keep his private life under wraps. On his firm avoidance of the subject of the boxes of possessions, the camp bed, the detritus of his evening meals and the bins every morning. Robin pondered her options. She could forget to relay the message, and simply tell him to call Charlotte and get her to do her own dirty work, as Robin put it to herself. What though if Strike refused to call, and somebody else told him about the engagement? Robin had no means of knowing whether Strike and his ex, girlfriend, fiancé, wife, had legions of mutual friends. If she and Matthew ever split up, if he became engaged to another woman, it gave her a twisting feeling in her chest to even think of it. All her closest friends and family would feel involved, and would undoubtedly stampede to tell her. She would, she supposed, prefer to be forewarned in as low-key and private a way as possible. When she heard Strike ascending the stair nearly an hour later, apparently talking on his mobile and in good spirits, Robin experienced a sharp stab of panic to the stomach
as though she were about to sit an exam. When he pushed open the glass door, and she saw that he was not holding a mobile at all, but rapping under his breath, she felt even worse.
"Fuck your meds and fuck Joe Harry," muttered Strike, who was holding a boxed electric fan in his arms.
"Afternoon."
"Hello."
"Thought we could use this. It's stuffy in here."
"Yes, that would be good."
"Just a DB Mac playing in the shop,"
Strike informed her, setting down the fan in a corner and peeling off his jacket.
"Something, something, and Ferrari. Fuck your meds and fuck Joe Harry."
"Wonder who Joe Harry was."
"Some rapper he was having a feud with, do you think?"
"No," said Robin, wishing that he was not so cheerful. "It's a psychological term. The Johari window. It's all to do with how well we know ourselves and how well other people know us."
Strike paused in the act of hanging up his jacket and stared at her.
"You didn't get that out of Heat magazine?"
"No, I was doing psychology at university. I dropped out." She felt obscurely that it might somehow even the playing field to tell him about one of her own personal failures before delivering the bad news.
"You dropped out of university?"
He seemed uncharacteristically interested.
"That's a coincidence. I did too. So why fuck Johari?"
"DB Mack had therapy in prison. He became interested and did a lot of reading on psychology.
I got that bit out of the papers," she added.
"You're a mine of useful information."
She experienced another elevator drop in the pit of her stomach.
"There was a call when you were out from a Charlotte Campbell."
He looked up quickly, frowning.
"She asked me to give you a message which was..." Robin's gaze slid sideways to hover momentarily on Strike's ear. "That she's engaged to Jago Ross."
Her eyes were drawn irresistibly back to his face, and she felt a horrible chill. One of the earliest and most vivid memories of Robin's childhood was of the day that the family dog had been put down. She herself had been too young to understand what her father was saying. She took the continuing existence of Bruno, her oldest brother's beloved Labrador, for granted. Confused by her parents' solemnity, she had turned to Stephen for a clue as to how to react, and all security had crumbled, for she had seen, for the first time in her short life, happiness and comfort drain out of his small and merry face, and his lips whiten as his mouth fell open. She had heard oblivion howling in the silence that preceded his awful scream of anguish, and then she had cried, inconsolably, not for Bruno, but for the terrifying grief of her brother. Strike did not speak immediately. Then he said with palpable difficulty,
"Right.
Thanks."
He walked into the inner office and closed the door. Robin sat back down at her desk, feeling like an executioner. She could not settle to anything. She considered knocking on the door again and offering a cup of tea, but decided against. For 5 minutes, she restlessly reorganized the items on her desk, glancing regularly at the closed inner door, until it opened again and she jumped and pretended to be busy at the keyboard.
"Robin, I'm just going to nip out," he said.
"Okay."
"If I'm not back at 5, you can lock up."
"Yes, of course."
"See you tomorrow."
He took down his jacket and left with a purposeful tread that did not deceive her. The roadworks were spreading like a lesion. Every day there was an extension of the mayhem and of the temporary structures to protect pedestrians and enable them to pick their way through the devastation. Strike noticed none of it. He walked automatically over trembling wooden boards to the Tottenham, the place he associated with escape and refuge. Like the Ordnance Arms, it was empty but for one other drinker, an old man just inside the door. Strike bought a pint of Doom Bar and sat down on one of the low red leather seats against the wall,
almost beneath the sentimental Victorian maid who scattered rosebuds, sweet and silly and simple. He drank as though his beer was medicine, without pleasure, intent on the result. Jago Ross. She must have been in touch with him, seeing him, while they were still living together. Even Charlotte, with all her mesmeric power over men, her astonishing sure-handed skill, could not have moved from reacquaintance to engagement in 3 weeks. She had been meeting Ross on the sly, while swearing undying love to Strike. This put a very different light on the bombshell she had dropped on him a month before the end, and the refusal to show him proof, and the shifting dates, and the sudden conclusion of it all. Jago Ross had been married once already. He had kids. Charlotte had heard on the grapevine that he was drinking hard. She had laughed with Strike about her lucky escape of so many years before. She had expressed pity for his wife. Strike bought a second pint, and then a third. He wanted to drown the impulses, crackling like electrical charges, to go and find her, to bellow, to rampage, to break Jago Ross's jaw. He had not eaten at the Ordnance Arms, and it had been a long time since he had consumed so much alcohol in one sitting. It took him barely an hour of steady, solitary, determined beer consumption to become properly drunk. Initially, when the slim, pale figure appeared at his table, he told it thickly that it had the wrong man and the wrong table. "No, I haven't," said Robin firmly. "I'm just going to get myself a drink too, all right." She left him staring hazily at her handbag, which she had placed on the stool. It was comfortingly familiar, brown, a little shabby. She usually hung it up on a coat peg in the office. He gave it a friendly smile, and drank to it. Up at the bar, the barman, who was young and timid-looking, said to Robin, "I think he's had enough." "That's hardly my fault," she retorted. She had looked for Strike in the Intrepid Fox, which was nearest to the office, in Molly Mogg's The Spice of Life and the Cambridge. The Tottenham had been the last pub she was planning to try. "What's the matter?" Strike asked her when she sat down.
"Nothing's the matter," said Robin, sipping her half-lager.
"I just wanted to make sure you're okay."
"Yes, I'm fine," said Strike.
And then, with an effort at clarity,
"I am fine."
"Good."
"Just celebrating my fiancée's engagement," he said, raising his 11th pint in an unsteady toast. "She should never have left him. Never," he said, loudly and clearly. "Have left. The Honourable Jago Ross, who is an outstanding cunt."
He virtually shouted the last word. There were more people in the pub than when Strike had arrived, and most of them seemed to have heard him. They had been casting him wary looks even before he shouted. The scale of him, with his drooping eyelids and his bellicose expression, had ensured a small no-go zone around him. People skirted his table on the way to the bathrooms, as though it was three times the size.
"Shall we take a walk?" Robin suggested. "Get something to eat."
"Do you know what?" he said, leaning forwards with his elbows on the table, almost knocking over his pint. "Do you know what, Robin?"
"What?"
she said, holding his beer steady. She was suddenly possessed of a strong desire to giggle. Many of their fellow drinkers were watching them.
"You're a very nice girl," said Strike. "You are. You're a very nice person. I've noticed," he said, nodding solemnly. "Yes, I've noticed that."
"Thank you," she said, smiling, trying not to laugh.
He sat back in his seat, closed his eyes and said,
"Sorry. I'm pissed."
"Yes."
"Don't do it much these days."
"No."
"I haven't eaten anything."
"Shall we go and get something to eat, then?"
"Yeah, we could do," he said, with his eyes still shut. "She told me she was pregnant."
"Oh," said Robin sadly.
"Yeah, told me. And then she said it was gone.
can't have been mine. Never added up.
Robin said nothing. She did not want him to remember that she had heard this. He opened his eyes.
She left him for me, and now she left him... No, she left me for him.
I'm sorry.
Left me for him. Don't be sorry. You're a nice person.
He pulled cigarettes out of his pocket and inserted one between his lips.
You can't smoke in here,
she reminded him gently. But the barman, who seemed to have been waiting for a cue, came hurrying over towards them now, looking tense.
You need to go outside to do that,
he told Strike loudly. Strike peered up at the boy, bleary-eyed, surprised.
It's all right,
Robin told the barman, gathering up her handbag.
Come on, Cormoran.
He stood, massive, ungainly, swaying, unfolding himself out of the cramped space behind the table and glaring at the barman, whom Robin could not blame for taking a step backwards.
There's no need, Strike told him, to shout. No need. Fucking rude.
Okay, Cormoran, let's go, said Robin, standing back to give him space to pass.
Just a moment, Robin,
said Strike, one large hand held aloft.
Just a moment.
Oh, God, said Robin quietly.
Have you ever done any boxing?
Strike asked the barman, who looked terrified.
Cormoran, let's go.
I was a boxer. In the army, mate.
Over at the bar, some wisecracker murmured. I could have been a contender.
Let's go, Cormoran, said Robin.
She took his arm, and to her great relief and surprise, he came along meekly. It reminded her of leading the enormous Clydesdale her uncle had kept on his farm. Out in the fresh air, Strike leaned back against one of the Tottenham's windows and tried, fruitlessly, to light his cigarette. Robin had to work the lighter for him in the end.
What you need is food, she told him,
as he smoked with his eyes closed, listing slightly so that she was afraid he would fall over.
Sober you up.
I don't want to sober up. Strike muttered.
He overbalanced and only saved himself from falling with several rapid sidesteps.
Come on,
she said, and she guided him across the wooden bridge spanning the gulf in the road where the clattering machines and builders had at last fallen silent and departed for the night.
Robin, did you know I was a boxer?
No, I didn't know that, she said.
She had meant to take him back to the office and give him food there, but he came to a halt at the kebab shop at the end of Denmark Street and had lurched through the door before she could stop him. Sitting outside on the pavement at the only table, they ate kebabs, and he told her about his boxing career in the army, digressing occasionally to remind her what a nice person she was. She managed to persuade him to keep his voice down. The full effect of all the alcohol he had consumed was still making itself felt, and food seemed to be doing little to help. When he went off to the bathroom, he took such a long time that she began to worry that he had passed out. Checking her watch, she saw that it was now 7:10. She called Matthew and told him she was dealing with an urgent situation at the office. He did not sound pleased. Strike wound his way back onto the street, bouncing off the doorframe as he emerged. He planted himself firmly against the window and tried to light another cigarette.
"Robin,"
he said, giving up and gazing down at her.
"Robin, do you know what a Kairos mo—"
he hiccuped.
"Moment is?"
"A Kairos moment," she repeated, hoping against hope it was not something sexual, something that she would not be able to forget afterwards, especially as the kebab shop owner was listening in and smirking behind them.
"No, I don't. Shall we go back to the office?"
"You don't know what it is?"
he asked, peering at her.
"No.
It's Greek,"
he told her.
"Kairos. Kairos moment. And it means
and from somewhere in his soused brain he dredged up words of surprising clarity.
The telling moment. The special moment. The supreme moment.
Oh, please, thought Robin, please don't tell me we're having one.
And do you know what ours was, Robin? Mine and Charlotte's, he said, staring into the middle distance, his unlit cigarette hanging from his hand. It was when she walked into the ward. I was in the hospital for a long time, and I hadn't seen her for 2 years, no warning. And I saw her in the door, and everyone turned and saw her too. And she walked down the ward, and she never said a word, and...
He paused to draw breath, and hiccuped again.
And she kissed me after 2 years, and we were back together. Nobody talking. Fucking beautiful. Most beautiful woman I've ever seen. Best moment of the whole fucking... my whole fucking life, probably. I'm sorry, Robin, he added, for saying fucking... I'm sorry about that.
Robin felt equally inclined to laughter and tears, though she did not know why she should feel so sad. Shall I light that cigarette for you?
You're a great person, Robin. You know that.
Near the turning into Denmark Street he stopped dead, still swaying like a tree in the wind, and told her loudly that Charlotte did not love Jago Ross. It was all a game to hurt him, strike, as badly as she could. Outside the black door to the office he halted again, holding up both hands to stop her following him upstairs.
You gotta go home now, Robin.
Let me just make sure you get upstairs, okay?
No, no. I'm fine now. And I might chunder. I'm legless. And...
said Strike.
You don't get that fucking tired old fucking joke, huh? Or do you? Know most of it now. Did I tell you?
I don't know what you mean.
Never mind, Robin. You go home now. I gotta be sick.
Are you sure?
I'm sorry I kept saying fuck, swearing. You're a nice person, Robin. Goodbye now.
She looked back at him when she reached Charing Cross Road. He was walking with the awful, clumsy deliberation of the very drunk towards the dingy entrance to Denmark Place, there, no doubt, to vomit in the dark alleyway, before staggering upstairs to his camp bed and kettle. Chapter 6. There was no clear moment of moving from sleep to consciousness. At first he was lying face down in a dreamscape of broken metal, rubble and screams, blooded and unable to speak. Then he was lying on his stomach, doused in sweat, his face pressed into the camp bed, his head a throbbing ball of pain, and his open mouth dry and rank. The sun pouring in at the unblinded windows scoured his retinas even with his eyelids closed, raw red, with capillaries spread like fine black nets over tiny, taunting, popping lights. He was fully clothed, his prosthesis still attached, lying on top of his sleeping bag as though he had fallen there. Stabbing memories, like glass shards through his temple, persuading the barman that another pint was a good idea. Robin, across the table, smiling at him. Could he really have eaten a kebab in the state he was in? At some point he remembered wrestling his fly, desperate to piss, but unable to extract the end of shirt caught in his zip. He slid a hand underneath himself, even this slight movement made him want to groan or vomit, and found, to his vague relief, that the zip was closed. Slowly, like a man balancing some fragile package on his shoulders, Strike moved himself into a sitting position and squinted around the brightly lit room with no idea what time it could be, or indeed, what day it was. The door between inner and outer offices was closed, and he could not hear any movement on the other side. Perhaps his temp had left for good. Then he saw a white oblong lying on the floor, just inside.